wants you to know, a lot of the episodes have mostly clean language, but this episode has some words in it that aren't meant for all ages. So, if you have kids like me in your house, you may want to put some headphones on for this one. You've been warned. Done, done, done.
Go on.
Dia Hoeth, which is welcome in Irish Gaelic. I'm Tim Wheaton. I'm the creator and host of the Daddy Unscripted podcast. Welcome to another episode. I'm happy to bring you this episode finally of myself speaking with KB, Kevin Browning, who is the manager amongst many other hats that he has worn and still kind of wears with the band Umphrey's McGee. Kevin and I had been working on recording this episode for quite some time, so I was really excited to finally get this one in the books for you all, and it will be one of two episodes with Kevin. We also have a very cool fork in the road episode that will be released the week after this one, I assume. So Kevin and I talked a lot in this first Daddy episode about many of the things that we feel are very important and meaningful about being parents. I think you guys will really get a lot out of this episode as far as who this man is and what he brings to the table in parenting, and actually like got into the philosophies of parenthood a little bit more than I have with some of the previous guests. So I really enjoyed the re-listen of this while I was having to edit it. So I hope you guys all get a lot out of it as well. So with no further ado, here is Kevin Browning. All right, so we are here today with Kevin Browning, who is the manager of the band Umphrey's McGee. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much for making this happen. This has been a work in progress for quite a while through your very busy schedule, so I really do sincerely appreciate you carving out some time to make this actually take place.
My pleasure.
So we'll go back into your history of parenting for this daddy episode as far as your dad and who he is and was at a younger age and what your relationship was with him as a child and all of that.
Sure. So I guess to just give a little context, my dad was grew up in a big Irish Catholic family in the Detroit area, and he had six brothers and sisters, and growing up, it was always sort of the norm to have these huge Christmas and Thanksgiving dinners where there'd be 30, 40, 50 people that were all related to me. And my dad grew up in a family that was a very sort of open and welcome household, where he would tell me these stories of neighborhood kids who, you know, they would walk in and out of the front doors of their neighbors' houses and come and go as they please. And Dad would tell me stories about one of his friends or his brothers and sisters' friends that would be having a hard time and would end up staying at their house for a week, and his parents might not even know it. And every morning for breakfast, literally, my grandparents would just feed whoever was there, whether it was their own six kids or not even their own six kids or plus four neighborhood kids or whatever. And it painted this very colorful picture of a little bit of a different time and place. You don't hear much of that anymore. But I think that kind of open door style stuck with me and is something that my wife and I have gravitated towards as we raise our kids and just try to make it an inclusive place. You know, specifically my relationship with my father, like most, is, you know, was full of ups and downs and complicated times and not so complicated times. And my parents got divorced when I was pretty young. I was about 6 years old when they got divorced. And that's complicated. It's messy. There's no good way to kind of navigate through that. But looking back, and you know, I have the experiences that I went through in the moment, and then I have the reflection of looking back on it with a different perspective, which I've done, you know, at various points in my life, both before and after being a dad. And I honestly feel differently about a lot of those things at different points in my life. When my parents got divorced, it was confusing. It didn't make any sense. I didn't understand it. Six is a tough age to kind of process why those things are happening, and generated a lot of anger and frustration. And it came out in, you know, ways kids do stuff by
yeah,
blowing up mailboxes and
yeah,
vandalizing stuff. Maybe stuff I would have done anyway, just, you know,
right.
Just a kid being a kid. But it definitely, it was hard and it was confusing. And, you know, as a little distance, I actually give both my parents a ton of credit, because one thing that they never did, no matter how much they probably wanted to, was that they never, ever sort of talked down about the other parent. My mom never, you know, now I can realize it was just seething in her to want to say something negative about my father, but she never did. And my dad did the same. And I never realized how difficult that must have been as a kid, but how important that probably was to not tainting my feeling about either one of them. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably had a more lasting impact than I realized back then. But so my dad, you know, part of the reason they got divorced was my dad, he worked his ass off. He's worked incredibly hard his whole life. And, you know, honestly, my dad was gone a ton when I was a kid. And I felt like, you know, the combination of that and then my parents not living under the same roof, I didn't see my dad nearly as much as, frankly, as I would have liked to. And there are a lot of things that he missed that were important to me then. And it, you know, it bothered me to varying degrees. And I didn't quite, you know, I didn't quite get it. When you're a kid, you just kind of roll with everything, but it wasn't how I guess wanted it to be at that point. I just didn't really understand. And as I got a little older, I realized that a lot of that hard work was for and on my behalf. My father, I had two older brothers and a younger sister. I also have two stepsisters when my dad got remarried. And I realized that a lot of that effort that he was putting in was so he could provide for us in a way that was really substantive and give us experiences and give us the opportunity to get great educations and to go to school where we wanted and to take trips. And so at sort of in college and after college, I kind of worked through all of those things and finally had a couple of those conversations with my dad that I wanted to have, but was frankly scared and intimidated to have, just about, hey, like, I was kind of pissed that you were gone all the time. And what's up with that? And, mm-hmm. and it, I've kind of come full circle on it, right? Like I realized that, while I didn't like it, and while it wasn't my first choice, that it was always done from a place that he was trying to do the right thing by a lot of people, myself included. Mm. And I was sort of able to let those things go and understand that while I disagreed with it, or while it wasn't the way that I felt like I would do it, that he had a pretty solid set of reasons for a lot of those things that he missed, because he was working hard to provide for us. So that's a long rambling answer there, but that's kind of the...
That wasn't too long a rambling.
Okay, good.
What was your dad doing for work back then?
Real estate construction development.
Okay. And when your parents divorced, did they stay? What was that situation like for you guys? Were you bouncing? Were you doing the half and half kind of thing? And were your parents still close geographically to one another?
They were close geographically, only about 10 minutes away.
Okay.
So that made it relatively easy. I spent every other weekend at my dad's. So every other weekend at my mom's, but basically lived at my mom's during the weeks, except for Wednesdays, which I would spend at my dad's. So it was, you know, it is what it is, but it worked.
Was your mom basically the housewife kind of thing, or was she working as well?
No, she was, I hesitate to say she wasn't working because she was raising right, four kids.
We all know what that's like.
It's a full-time job plus, you know, the idea that that our society somehow views a stay-at-home mom as a simpler or less work than somebody who goes, you know, to a 40 or 50 hour a week job is sorely mistaken, as that's an incredibly challenging and difficult thing to raise kids. My mom was around. She was the opposite of my dad in a ton of ways. Very mm-hmm. emotionally available, very supportive. Not that my dad wasn't supportive, but my mom was sort of always there, always bending over backwards for us. And they had very different parenting styles that, again, with the benefit of hindsight, I see real value in both of them, even though they were pretty disparate. And, you know, one thing about parenting well is presenting a unified front between mom and dad. And my wife and I work pretty hard to make sure that's the case, even if we have disagreements about that. At least in the moment, you present a unified front, and then you work it out behind the scenes and go from there. But my mom and dad are really different styles, and that sort of aggravated both of them. But I looked at it as, hey, you know what? My mom did these things really well. My dad did these things really well. I don't like the way each of them did X, Y, and Z. And I sort of taken my approach of, I took a third from my mom, I took a third from my dad, and then I took a third from me and my wife. And at least that's how the basis of it kind of started. And then over the years, you sort of just morph into more of who you are. But they both provided valuable insights, both positive and negative.
Did your mom remarry?
No.
Okay, so you didn't have a stepdad situation to deal with?
Nope.
Okay. And how different was your wife's parental situation from yours?
Fairly, you know, her parents are still together. You know, in that context, it was very different. But at the core, I'd say there's actually a lot of similar shared values between our parents, and therefore between us, and allowed sort of an even playing field, if you will. We sort of both had similar outlooks on a lot of things. And in some ways, my family did things differently than hers. Mm-hmm. But it was in the same ballpark, at least broad strokes.
Right. And is your wife from the same area as you, or no?
Nope. So I'm from Indianapolis originally. My wife is from Des Moines. We met in South Bend at college.
Okay.
But yeah, the Humphreys thing came together at Notre Dame, and a bunch of us came from all the Midwest, basically between Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, and all sort of formed in South Bend at Notre Dame.
And we'll get to that in the next episode some more, for those of you who just heard Humphreys and your ears perked up and thought we were going to go into that. We're not yet. You're going to have to wait. So how much of your discussion of your upbringing and your wife's upbringing did you guys kind of bring to the table before you had children? Or
By the time we got to have, having kids, we had already sort of discussed everything under the sun at that point. My wife and I do our best to keep a pretty open line of communication, and we have, growing up, when we met and we were falling in love, and there's really no closed doors, and she got everything, the good, bad, and the ugly about my family, and I the same about hers, and those things just naturally lead to conversations about, you know, who you are and what you value and how you want to raise a family. And my wife and I also delayed having kids. I mean, we met when we were young. We met, she was 19, I was 20. We waited to have kids. We were married for over 5 years before we had our first our first kid, because we decided, you know, there's a lot of things that we wanted to do. There's a lot of, basically we wanted it to be about us for a while, and allowed us to travel and see a lot of the world and be sort of selfish and focus on each other and our respective careers at the same time. And so we had already been, you know, we met in 1999, we got married in 2005, and our oldest daughter, Murphy, was born in 2011. So by the time we got there, we had, we'd sort of been around the block and then some, and we're pretty eye to eye on at least how we thought we would want to do it.
Mm-hmm. And her upbringing, was there, you said that, well, you didn't actually say that your family was, your dad was in a, Catholic family situation. Was there any of that carried over to your immediate family?
I mean, we as we were raised, I mean, specifically to the Catholic piece.
Yeah.
We were raised Catholic, and so was my wife, actually. And in our situation, the older that we got, you know, we were raised that way, but as we sort of got older, it was more on us to decide from there. And you know, with her situation, and her mom, and I actually give her mom a lot of credit for this, that she saw a lot of hypocrisy in the church they were at the time, and felt like a place that doesn't value my daughters in the same way as my son doesn't seem like something I should be, you know, I should be making my kids do. And they kind of backed it off of it a little. And that was sort of the same thing that I was going through at the time. So that's a complicated subject, and one for another.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And a whole nother podcast, but
I just was curious. It's always an interesting thing, whether for this podcast or for another, how that side of it gets a lot of times, I think, obviously because of the generational difference. You know, you're talking, what year was your dad born?
He was born in 46.
Okay. So you're talking about a massive generational difference, obviously, from now to then, but even from when you were a kid to somebody who's, you know, in their kid and teen years in the 50s, and I'm speaking a little bit out of my butt here because I don't know Midwest life all that well, but I'm assuming that there's not that much difference between Catholic upbringing in a sizable family between the Midwest or whatever state it may be in to now, and how that kind of gets diluted as people are alive in a very different societal America. And I think with most people that I've talked to that kind of have that in their background, it continues to kind of get more and more diluted to the point of, you know, we have maybe a respect for what that was or what we went through as a kid, but that's not something that we are raising our families with, unless it's a, oh boy, you're right, this is for a different podcast. Unless it's like a cultural kind of thing, you know, I like strong Roman Catholic families or Greek Catholic families or something like that, or maybe even Irish Catholics. But for the most part, that can be an interesting tale about how that kind of gets watered down as the generations go, and how people kind of open their eyes more, I guess.
Yeah, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to overgeneralize, but I tend to agree with you that broadly speaking, that is a trend that we're seeing, and it's accurate in our house as well. So I think you're, you know, again, it's, don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but I think that's more the norm than not, at least in the world that I feel like I'm living in, and the people that I'm observing and friends around me. So,
yeah, you can leave that. Anybody who has any kind of a grump with that, you can lay that on me. I was the one who did that harsh generalization. I don't want to put you on any hot seats or whatever. Yeah, definitely a different podcast. We'll find the Midwest Irish Catholic podcast and get you right on there right away.
can't wait.
Yeah. So anyhow, bringing it way back, you and your wife going into that part of the changes in your life and lifestyle. So this would have been, Murphy is how old now?
She is 5.
Okay. During, I'm kind of looking towards the sky and trying to do fast math in my head. At the time that you married, the band was kind of really starting to push off a little bit more at, around that time. Yes. 2005.
Yeah, there was a lot going on, and honestly, there were a lot of, we were gone. There was a lot of shows in those middle years, 2003, 4, 5, 6. I mean, there's still a lot of shows. It's all sort of relative, but, you know, there's a couple of years there, where there was 150, 160 shows, and that's just shows. So you factor in the days off and travel days and whatnot, and you're gone a pretty substantial amount of the time. And that was hard. It's hard on a relationship. And it's also hard as you reflect on having kids. And, you know, for me, it was the same thing. It was, I don't want to be gone, this much, because one of the things, you know, as I said, one of the things that pissed me off was not having my dad there, for a bunch of it. So, you know, that's another part of the reason that we waited a little bit. But to your point, there was a lot happening, and we've been pushing pretty hard on this thing for 18 years now, and that was certainly no different around the time that we got married.
And so when you're having that conversation and wanting to wait to have kids and wanting to have it be about you, are there certain kind of landmarks or different spots that you're wanting to hit in life, specifically maybe even with the band or personally, that you guys were also wanting to wait on? Or was it like a, let's wait 5 years?
No, we never put too fine a point on it. We felt like the time would be obvious when we were both ready. You know, there weren't strict benchmarks that we have to, you know, we got to be playing this many shows, or we got to be making this much money, or we sort of never went there. Shay, Shay works full time, and she was in the process of, you know, of growing and finding her footing. And we, at the end of the day, when people sit down to try to decide whether or not they're going to have kids, you're never going to be ready to have kids. Like, yeah, as it, you know, you can make, you kind of got to just pull the trigger. But we had felt like we had, you know, we'd been together for a long time, and we had been able to check a lot of those boxes and do a lot of that travel. And, you know, you start to get a little bit older and you realize, hey, if we want to have 3 kids, that, you know, by the time we do it, you start projecting the math and figuring out that, hey, I don't want to be 40 and having the last one, or that's, it doesn't, you know, I just use a random,
it's okay.
Certainly can have kids at 40 by all means. It was just, just our conversations of like, okay, let's try to do it like this. And so so all of you listening, given that we're 25 minutes into this without detailing, I do have 3 kids, 2 girls and a boy. Our oldest, is 5. Our middle child Bowie is 3, and our youngest boy Teddy is 1. So we have them pretty close together. We kind of waited a while, and then once we started, we kind of clustered them to try to get it on and keep them close.
Yeah. And did you at any point during that have this has always kind of been one of my wife and my discussion about the gap that we wanted to put between the kids, was we didn't want to have 2 kids in diapers at the same time. Did you guys have to go through that at all with any of them?
Yeah, we have 2 in diapers right now. We ignored, I mean, our 3-year-old is transitioning out, but we had, my theory on it is that at the end of the day, it's, it's a shit show regardless.
It's true.
So
true.
Let's not split hairs here and over whether or not they can be in diapers or not.
Yeah. I applaud you on being able to do the three kid thing. Before my wife and I had kids at all, we were in awe of parents with kids, and we knew we wanted to, but it was still like, God, how do you do that? And still to this day, seeing parents that have more than two just astonishes me. And I just feel like I would be so overwhelmed with that one extra kid that you're outmanned now.
Yeah. You go from the double team with one kid to a man to man with two, and then you're running a zone defense.
Yeah. You're in your box and one now.
We found that the transition from one to two was much tougher than the transition from two to three, because one of you, when push comes to shove, can take a break. And, and when there's two, now you're sort of both on a lot more of the time. But with three, it's just like, it's already crazy. What's another one in the litter?
Right.
So we've even discussed four, but that door is just about fully closed. There's a tiny sliver of light in there, but it's a pretty heavy door that's shutting on it. So
yeah,
we love big families. Like she's one of three. I said, I'm one of six. We have, I've got 20 nieces and nephews.
Oh, geez.
Literally Thanksgiving dinner at our house is 45 people plus, and that's just immediate family. That's not even aunts and uncles. And we love that. And we wanted our kids to have each other as companions. And Shay and I are both close with our brothers and sisters, and we felt like that was that was something we wanted to give to our family as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask how many siblings she has as well. I am the youngest of eight, so I think that kind of that pressure of seeing my mom basically buckling under the weight of all of us kids always kind of scared me away from having too many. But we started so late. I mean, I'm going to be that dad already. That is the story I always use, is because my dad was kind of that way. They had me when my dad was, I think, 41 or 42. And I remember my dad being in the stands at some of my games, whether it was like junior high or high school, and my teammates saying, "Oh, your grandpa came to watch you play." And I would just like kind of put my head down and say, "No, that's my dad." So I know I'm already going to be at that level with my own kids. So yay for genes, I guess. Yeah. So my wife, she has just her one brother. Her dad was also one of eight, but her mom was one of two as well. So I think she kind of, it was a lot easier for her to take that side of agreement of having less kids. And it was just a struggle for us in all phases of pregnancy and getting pregnant and childbirth and everything. So we feel fortunate to even have the two that we have, and we don't want to, you get to that point where you can't really push your luck too much.
Sure. Totally. I mean, the moms are heroes in every which way, shape, and form. The, what you got to go through to actually bring a child into this world is really something else. And I make no judgments on the way anybody does it, because it's easier or harder for some people at various parts of the process. And, there's no one size fits all. There's no best way to do it. I know some families that have, that have a single child that's, it's spectacular and they wouldn't change anything about it. And you can have a family that's 10 kids and it works. And to me, it's, it's a futile exercise to try to impart your will or hey, this way works best, or you should do this. I mean, that's not a decision that anybody gets to make besides the people that are bringing life into the world or raising a child. So,
yeah, when you're in the, I mean, the one advice that we've most constantly given to friends or whatever is do what works for you and your kid. Like, you, whether that means, like, you know, we always said from the get-go, we will never have a kid in bed with us, period. We can't imagine that people do that. And God, look, some of them get stuck, like their kids in bed with them until they're 6 years old or whatever. And if you have a kid that will absolutely not sleep, and for some people that is, you know, they go through the screaming kid and putting them back to bed 30 times a night and they get no sleep doing it, and they only have to do that for 5 nights and then magically their kid adapts, and for some it's a month or whatever, and some kids just are never going to adapt to that until they make that decision on their own that they're ready to sleep in their own bed or whatnot. And we always said we would never do that, and here we are with our now 4-year-old who goes to sleep in his own bed, but in the middle of the night at some point, whether it's 3 in the morning or 5 in the morning or whatever, he comes and he's a huge cuddler. He's a very needy kid that just wants to always kind of be with us and is kind of like that, you know, he's our little buddy and whatever. And if he wants that at night, what am I going to do? So,
yeah, it's drawing a line in the sand about exactly how you're going to be before things go down is a dangerous thing to do, because, you know, this, like you said, when you're sleep deprived, and at some point it's got to be about what works best, you know, not just for the kids, but for you, for the parents, because you got to get up and function and do your thing. And there's all sorts of things you think we'll never do this, we'll always do that, that you end up going, geez, I didn't know. And I don't know what the hell I was talking about.
Right. And can completely, I am still somewhat surprised, even though it really shouldn't be a surprise at all, at how within that microcosm of a house, of a group of people under one roof that are, you know, a family, how different one kid can be from the other. I mean, the absolute complete opposite thing will work or can work. You know, you get one amazing sleeper and you get one that is the worst sleeper in the world. You know, kind of like they say, if you have a angel child first, be ready for your second to be the devil, or vice versa. Parenting is crazy.
It is. It's the most, you know, it's the most challenging thing I think you'll ever do. It's also the most rewarding thing. It's, you know, it's equal parts. It's so fun. I really derive a ton of joy from it. It's also incredibly nerve-wracking and can be stressful and frustrating. And I mean, it runs the gamut of emotions. And we try to just remember that, you know, that you're supposed to enjoy it. It's supposed to be fun. Mm-hmm. And when you get too far in the weeds about being overly concerned about, you know, am I doing this right? Am I screwing this up? Like, it's, you lose sight of the big picture. And that is that it's supposed to be fun, and you're supposed to, you know, when you're enjoying it and your kids see you having fun with it and being happy, that, you know, that gets picked up by them. And if you're constantly yelling and stressed and nagging, that also gets picked up by them. And it's really challenging to kind of walk that line, because you got to lay down the law and you got to have rules. And to me, it's sort of about picking and choosing your battles. And, you know, my wife and I still work on this regularly. It's like, you know, what things are really important. And there's a lot of things that you let bother you or annoy you that just aren't that important. You know, your kids are going to do, you know, especially as they as they get a little older, and you know, they spend so much time figuring out boundaries and what they can and can't do, and I found myself saying no to some things where I'm like, all right, let's think, let's pull back, big picture. That doesn't actually matter if they do that. I may be like annoyed by it, or it may be, but it's really not important. And I've tried to put those things in perspective and just sort of pick and choose, because they're, you have to let them, you got to let them go through a lot of those things on their own. You got to let them make those mistakes on their own. You have to, you got to give them the independence to go figure a lot of these things out for themselves without trying to, you know, without trying to come down on too much.
So pulling that kind of back, how strict were your parents with you when you were a kid?
Medium strict.
a 4 out of 5 or whatever.
Yeah. You know, I always, again, like I had two different scenarios. So when I was at my mom's house, it was a different set of rules than my dad's house. And that, that drove my mom fucking crazy. I can tell you that. But I never felt like they were overly strict. I felt like there was an adequate amount of discipline that allowed me, you know, kids need boundaries and they need some parameters. And I felt like I had that. I also felt like they didn't keep me from doing a lot of the things that I wanted. So, and I appreciate that. I appreciated it. You know, not always then when you're, you know, when you get in trouble for something and you get a real consequence that feels like, oh, it feels like your world's going to end at 16, at 16. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's not that big a deal. Those things leave a mark and you realize. So I, you know, on the spectrum, I'd probably put it in the middle.
Yeah.
But it felt like the right amount.
And now as you are parenting now, do you feel like you consciously at some times even think big picture of, let me think about who I am now. Let me think about some of those things that I did when I was younger and some of the consequences or punishments or whatever that were put on me or the boundaries. Do you kind of project those into your parenting of your own kids, do you think?
I do. And Shay and I talk about this at some length that it's, I have a tendency to, you know, there are rules and you got to follow them, and that's, you know, period. But I have a tendency to value the independence over discipline to some degree. And sometimes I think that the discipline can be, you know, can supplant that. And I don't ever want to crush a kid's will. And, but at the same token, and my wife is entirely right, it's, I've always believed that you got to treat them. I don't treat my kids like kids, if you will. I talk to them like the human beings that they are. And we have pretty, you know, I don't dumb it down. I don't, you know, they're bright, intelligent little people from a really young age. Mm-hmm. And I think that they ought to be respected and treated that way. But at the same time, you know, my wife is entirely right that if you, you know, there's some things that you just have to be clear from incredibly young, or the fear is that they'll take advantage and walk on you. And, you know, so that's, I would say the, I give my wife tons of credit. I think she probably has the harder of the two jobs and that she's more of the disciplinarian than I am. I don't consider myself a pushover, but she definitely lays down the law a little bit more. And that's, you know, it's hard. And that's why I give her so much credit, is because of course, a lot of times that's, well, mommy, you're being mean. Like I want to be with daddy. And I don't ever want, you know, when that happens, it's no, your mom and I are in the same place on this. Like, but I know that it's hard, you know, it's hard for her to see that. And so, but I, you know, I agree with her that it's necessary, and you gotta, you know, I think she has the harder task a little bit. I think maybe I have a tendency to treat them maybe a little too much like adults when they're 2.5 years old. But I, you know, there's some things that you can't, obviously you can't get and you can't rationalize and logically work through at that age. But there's so much more of it that I think that you really can. And I think that long term, I feel good about the, you know, sort of the method of the way that we communicate with our kids. And my wife does the same thing. She's, you know, she treats them, we expect a lot of them. They have, you know, we don't treat them like babies. We have high expectations, and kids, they'll rise to that. And
yeah,
they'll understand that, hey, this is how we roll. And there's some things that will slide on that aren't that important. There's some things that, you know, we absolutely won't slide on. I joke to Shay, I'm like, hey, you know what? Our kids may be heroin dealers, but they are going to be the most polite heroin dealers you've ever met. Please and thank you with every transaction. You know, there's just some things there's no, absolutely no, you know, no way around.
So since there is that kind of little bit of difference between you guys, is she kind of connecting with you when you come home, whether it's from you being at the office, quote unquote, or whether it's you being gone for a few days, or you coming back and she's kind of saying, okay, this is what happened with Murphy, and I want to make sure that you know what I told her? Or is there more of a common ground that you already are kind of in the know? Is Murphy kind of starting to take advantage of the mom and dad difference, or trying to?
She certainly has tried to. We put the kibosh on that in a hurry. That's where we feel like if you give it all, that you set yourself up for success or for failure for the long run. So that's, you know, we talk about it. Like, even if Shay and I disagree on something, whoever said it first, that's the law for at least for the day until your mom and I've talked about it. We've decided that you can, you know, that this is okay. So, you know, when there's something that needs to be communicated about, hey, this is what came up and this is how it happened. We do it. Sometimes everything is always sort of a work in motion because, you know, a lot of time we're both gone. So we don't know until we both come home, or, you know, sometimes you got to roll with it on the spot. But overall, at least at this point, there's not too many things that have arisen that are, you know, these huge things that we got to work through yet. I'm sure, you know, I have no doubt that as our kids get older, it'll get more complicated, and they'll
start getting a united front against you guys. And
they'll take the same approach. They already do that. Honestly, some of the things that they do, you know, you have to scold them for, and then Shay and I walk out of the room and we're like, that was fucking clever. We love those attributes in our kids. Like I like, especially my girls, like that's a skill that is going to set them up for success in a world that sometimes has a strike against them. It's tougher. And for them to like assess a situation and come up with a strategy to get what they want, I value that, and I encourage it. And, you know, you rein it in sometimes when they're clearly just trying to conniving, but overall, like that's a great attribute that we want to foster.
Yeah. That's an excellent effort. No, but I'm glad that you're thinking. Are you giving any kind of that praise to them, or is that completely behind closed doors because you don't want to perpetuate that more?
No, we absolutely tell them, like, that's a good try, that's a well reasoned, but the answer is no, and here's why. I think they also can sense it when, you know, they say something and both of us will smile. And it's like, you know, they get it. They get that they're trying to game it, or they're pushing a boundary, and or they're like, maybe this will work. I think that you got to let kids fail a lot on their own and figure out solutions on their own. It's a tendency when your kid falls down and gets to run over and make sure everything's okay. And I get it, and I want to do it you know, I want to do that the same way, because all you want is your kids to be happy and healthy and whatnot. But
right,
you also, the value that they will get from overcoming those obstacles themselves is something that you cannot teach. And so you got to get out of the way. You got to let them do that. And I also think it's the same way with risks. And a lot of times the things that parents and just people in general think are risky behaviors for kids to do, I think are really not necessarily that risky. For a kid, it just has to be a perceived risk, right? That they're mm-hmm. like in a situation, I mean, this is young at the park on a jungle gym. There's a perceived risk about, you know, going up the climbing wall that is literally 6 feet off of the, you know, the top of it's 6 feet off of the ground, right?
Right.
I'm okay with letting them get to the top and falling off. Like I'm not going to stand there and make sure that they don't slip, because to me, it's, you got to let them take those risks so that they can overcome them. And then they figure out that, hey, I can do it. It teaches overcoming obstacles is a huge learning experience, and it teaches self-efficacy. And if you're always there to assist them, they don't learn how to figure those things out for themselves. And so I think, you know, setting them up for the big picture in the long run, letting them take some of those risks young and overcoming them, the sense of accomplishment that a kid gets when they have a problem and a puzzle and they figure it out on their own, is that something happens at age 3, 4, 5, 6 that is absolutely with you at age 30, 40, 50, 60. Like, mm-hmm. and so to me, I want to let them do those things. I want to let them do those things on their own, because I don't think there's any way to learn that otherwise. You can't just tell a kid to be resourceful. The kid has to, yeah. got to figure that stuff out on their own. So those are things that I want to try to give all of my kids. I think that, you know, back to that sort of independence, I want them to make those mistakes young, and when they're at home, and as opposed to trying to just shelter and overprotect and not let kids ever be in situations where they can make those mistakes. And as they get older and you get to be teenagers and they start going to parties and kids are doing, kids are doing things that are risky. Like I want to be able to have conversations about that stuff, honestly. And I want them to be able to, to understand and to experience that those things as at a young enough age that you can make a mistake and learn from it and move on. Like one of the things that was really eye-opening for me my freshman year at Notre Dame was some of these kids who would come and they would get blackout drunk on a Friday mm-hmm. night. And I was like, whoa, like I would follow up the next day and I would just like inquire about, you know, tell me about where you came from. Like, and the, you know, parents that would never let their kids, they would never give them a long enough leash is a bad analogy, but they'd never give them enough slack to go do something dumb and to, sneak a couple beers at 17. And then they get to college and they're blackout drunk. And it's like it's really easy for one mistake at that point to follow you around for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be a challenging line to walk. And particularly with the sort of hyperactive parenting and legality of, you know, something happens at your house or under your mm-hmm. care. And next thing you know, you're getting sued by some kid's mom. And it's like, that stuff is really unfortunate to me. You know, I'm not advocating for any sort of reckless encouragement or behavior. I think that everybody has to go through making mistakes and figuring things out on their own. And to me, I'd rather have it happen when they're on the younger side and under my care, and when the consequences of it are a lot less than they could be, you know, once they get to a certain age.
Right. It's like trying some of the trapeze tricks while the safety net is still there, instead of just going out into the big circus and doing everything and falling and to your death, basically. To put it very mildly.
Yes.
So what was that, kind of dipping back a little bit into some of that? What was that for you when you were a kid? Was that kind of your route? Were you given that kind of slack? It sounds like potentially a little bit more under your dad's eye, quote unquote, than your mom's. But were you able to kind of have that ability to make those mistakes and kind of feel your way through some of those boundaries and some of those potential risks when you were a kid?
Definitely. And, you know, this was the difference between my mom and my dad. And you're right in that my dad had an understanding that boys will be boys and they're going to go get into stuff. I would rather, you know, my dad was adamant about never drinking and driving, and he drove it in, you know, it's just a point that he was so adamant to drive into us. And, you know, his discussing it now and looking back on it, it was, listen, you guys were going to be on a Friday night, in high school, you guys were going to be out, drinking beer or smoking pot. I don't want you driving around in a car with nowhere to go where you really could get into serious trouble, or you could hurt somebody. And so wasn't always overtly spoken, but it was, hey, you can have a couple buddies over. Everybody leaves their keys with me. Everybody's spending the night, and, you know, you can have a few beers in the basement. And that's just sort of what it was. And that gave us the ability to do what we 110% were going to do anyway, mm-hmm. in an environment that was safe, and gave us the, you sort of get some of that out of your system. And then you don't feel like you have to, if you don't feel like you have to sneak around it. And, you know, every kid's different. Not every kid is going to want to do that or is going to need to do that. And, you know, we haven't sort of touched on it, but you inevitably parent differently to different kids, because we don't all require the same thing. And something that you got to drill into one kid, the other kid got from the very first time you said it. So mm-hmm. you got to be flexible enough and realistic enough to know that there's no one size fits all here. And something that my dad said young that resonated with me and all of my brothers and sisters, and I still think about how it's going to inform my decisions as a dad. But my youngest sister, Katie, you know, so it was three boys and then my younger sister, Katie. And Katie would ask my dad to do something in high school, and he would say no. And she would get so upset, and she'd be like, but she's like, you let the boys do the exact same thing at the exact same age. Like, there's a double standard. And my dad's like, you're damn right, there's a double standard. He's like, I'm sorry. He's like, you're a 16-year-old girl, not a 16-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. And it enraged my sister, you know, and she was so upset with it. But my dad saw it as, listen, it's just a different environment out in this context than it was for a boy. So I'm sorry you're pissed, but that's the deal. It's the rules are different. And my brothers and sisters and I talk about that now, like, inevitably, and they all have older kids than I do. And every once in a while, something will come up and, you know, somebody will joke that, yep, it's just a double standard, like the old dad double standard. Like, mm-hmm. So we'll see, you know, at 5'3" and 1, it's not so much of an issue yet, but I'm certain that at some point it will be.
And do they all have mix of kids as well? Do they all have boy and girl?
Yeah, my oldest brother has five. There's 21 nieces and nephews, total, just on my side.
Just in four of you. That's crazy.
That's actually in six, but literally we have three kids, and that's the smallest family size there is three kids, which a couple of us have three kids, but my older brother has four kids, and they had two kids and then adopted two kids. Oh, okay. So there's a fun dynamic there. And then my older brother has five kids, and it's a lot. It's quite the matrix.
Yeah, that's cool. In my family, my siblings, my brother who I work with here, who's a year and a half older than me, we are the only naturals. My parents adopted six. So I know about that different dynamic within the family.
Sure.
Which basically ends up being pretty much a moot point inside the family. It's more of a difference to other people, I think, than anybody else.
Yeah, that from my experience, and my sister adopted one as well, and from my experience, that's definitely true, and even more so in our case, because my brothers and sisters are all white and they adopted black children. So the looks you get from people who are like just head scratching, trying to figure out like exactly what's going on here. Can be, you get a little bit of everything. But it's,
there's no love lost.
Yeah. It makes zero difference inside the family with brothers and sisters and cousins and whatnot. It's just the perception from, from people that
from outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the way the last child that my parents adopted was my Korean sister, who the rest of them were all adopted before my brother and I were born because they couldn't have kids. And so they just kind of gave up and started adopting kids. And then miraculously, when my mom was 40, she got, or 39, I guess, with my brother, she got pregnant, and then she got pregnant again with me. And then they adopted my Korean sister. And at the time, I think I was maybe 4 or 5, and I think she was maybe 9 or 10. So that was kind of obvious. I knew what something was kind of up with that one. But with the others, they're my brothers and sisters that helped raise me, basically. So there was no real knowledge of that until people kind of started talking about it. And I only remember one time, and boy, was I really pissed off ever. I was once in a fight with one of my older brothers, and I regrettably said, "You're not even my real brother." And I think that probably, like, in a movie, that would have echoed, and they would have pulled back from the house, and you would have heard the echo, and like the whole city would have heard it, basically. that was the only time that anything like that ever really came up. We all are pretty close for how big our family is and how widespread everything is now. We don't do Thanksgiving like you guys do, which is one of the things that I definitely regret. I wish we had everybody together, but it would be sizable like your situation. I think it resonated with me when I saw somebody. Oh, I think it was when Mary Welch posted a photo of Punky at CK5's light board on social media last week or something. And one of the comments was, "It's going to be so rad when she is older and she realizes all the cool stuff that she did." And I think that's such a true statement, not just about that, but in general, like, of all the work that we do as parents for our kids, that for me, I think about it consciously more than not, is this is something I want my kids to look back on. And I don't want to be away from my kids so much that is a regret for me, or a, one of those angry thoughts that they have when they're older, or for it to be a situation that they are not looking back on all of these fond memories with both myself and my wife, and having as many pleasant experiences as they can, and as many good positive learning experiences as well that they're able to look back on when they're old and shriveled up like me.
Yep, no doubt. I certainly have the, when I look back and realize a bunch of the things that I got to do when I was young that I did not appreciate, or at least did not appreciate nearly as fully as maybe not as I should have, but as you can't really until you have a little bit more perspective about the bigger picture. But I look back and I think of all these great memories that were created when I was just being, just shepherded around. And those are some, those are some lasting and incredible memories. And we we are certainly trying to craft those same things for kids. I also think there's real value in just taking your kids places and exposing them to new ideas and to new people and to new situations and cultures. And, you know, that stuff makes neurons fire like crazy and gives kids context and allows them to think outside of just their sort of day to day. And those things are good for people. I mean, they're good at any age, but you can really expand. The brain is such a sponge at a young age that you can really expand their horizons in a hurry and set them up. I mean, I think those things stay with people for a lifetime, even when they happen at young ages. So I certainly value those experiences that I had and try to do the same to pass them on to the next generation.
Yeah. And remembering like that, you know, you always kind of talk about the sacrifice that parents make. And a lot of it is really a sacrifice of selfishness when it comes down to it. Really, it's like these are things that you maybe want to do for yourself or for yourselves, you as spouses, but that you are now having to kind of cut out of your life for your kids. But thinking about the sacrifice of things that you maybe really don't want to do that could be such great experiences for your kids that could be as small as, you know, going to one of those bouncy house places or whatever on a weekday or a weekend. And the like least fun place for a parent to go, unless you're one of the parents who gets in there and bounces with them.
No, but you're right. My wife and I, there's so many of these. We were just talking about a birthday present for Bowie, and it was like, we could take her to Build-A-Bear, and like, she's like, look at the look on your face right now. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, you're right. Like, that sounds terrible. I'm like, let's just Amazon the thing. 2 days, I'll be here.
Yeah.
You know? And she's good about reminding me that those things are valuable. And it's true. You know, some of those are sacrifices that are absolutely just, we should make. And
So did you guys end up going to Build-A-Bear?
We ordered it on Amazon, but in my defense, it was because they didn't have the one that we knew our daughter was going to want.
Oh, okay.
She's been asking for a rainbow bear very specifically, and they didn't have it in the Chicago store. So I guess I lucked out on that one.
Yeah. That's funny because my daughter just turned 8 at the end of September, and we took her to Build-A-Bear, and she didn't have anything specific that she wanted or anything like that. But it was, even though I really had to keep myself from judging the people that were working there, they put on a pretty cool thing. Like, they, you know, give it a birth certificate, and they gave my daughter a little sticker button because it was her birthday. And, you know, they do this big kind of presentation while they're making it and everything. It's kind of a cool thing, and I will never say that aloud again. I only have to say it this one time, and it's recorded forever. But
this podcast will self-destruct in 3, exactly. 2.
For the kids, it was cool. So,
well, at least we buried that right at the end. So
yeah, easily edit it out in case I don't want that out there. All right. Well, I think we've pretty much covered the parenting thing pretty fully. I'll give a little thing at the end of this, but I should have you do this. Whatever social media tags you want to allow people to find you or the band at, you can run through your gamut right now.
Sure. You can find me on pretty much all of the Twitter and Instagram are at soundcaresser, one word. I tend to post a fair amount of pictures of my children to Instagram, as well as a fair amount of pictures of bottles of wine, which is a very key ingredient in parenting that we have clearly glossed over here. But I can tell you for certain, I would not have 3 children if it was not for fermented grape juice. And I mean that with the utmost respect to wine. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and then all things Umphrey's you can find at at Umphreys McGee on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. You name it. The yet to be invented social platform that'll be super relevant by the time some of you hear this.
Mm-hmm. We'll be at Periscope, which you guys briefly dabbled in.
Yeah, Periscope kind of got IAB'd Periscope, and once Facebook Live happened, the reality is that the reach of I go where the people go, and the reach of Facebook Live versus Periscope is not even close.
Yeah, you're already connected to so many people there, and with the new, regardless of how cool the apps may be or whatever, getting people to also add this other thing that they have to be on, that's kind of the reaction I frequently see is,
yes,
you want me to follow you on what now too?
Yep.
Yeah.
Fatigue is set in.
All right. Well, thank you very much for sitting down, and we will take a little break and record our Fork in the Road episode, which you guys will all be able to listen to. It'll probably end up coming out either a week from the release of this one or a week after that. So keep an eye out for that episode with Kevin. All right. Thanks, Kevin.
Yep. Thank you.
And there you have it. There is the first of two episodes with Kevin Browning, the manager of Umphreys McGee. I hope you guys really enjoyed that episode. I know that to me, I will just say this. I, through this conversation with Kevin and through the re-listen of it during the editing process for me, it really inspired me to be a better dad, a better parent, and to think about some of the stuff that I encounter in my day-to-day with the kids and with my wife. And I just think that this was really a nice episode about parenting and what that can mean and what it does and should mean to a lot of people as well. So I hope you guys really enjoyed that. I will remind you that you can find Daddy Unscripted on its original website, daddyunscripted.com. That's where you can find some of the original posts that weren't even before the podcast was even an idea. So some of the original writings that I did, you can find all the episodes there. You can also find Daddy Unscripted on Facebook, on Instagram now, on Twitter. And you can find us, if you didn't, on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, all of those formats. So I would love to get your guys' feedback, which you can send to daddyunscripted@gmail.com. Let me know what other guests you'd love to hear from, what you maybe aren't liking or are really liking about the podcast so far. I love getting that insight from you guys. I've gotten a couple of really good ideas sent to me on new guests that I should have on the show, which I never would have thought of on my own. So thank you very much for doing that, and keep that coming in. So one more week and you will be ready to listen to the Fork in the Road episode with KB and myself, where we talk a lot about the origins of the band Umphreys McGee and a lot of the process that goes into the brain trust behind a lot of the ideas that are taken into play, some of the decision-making process on different things. I really learned a lot and tried to ask some of the questions that you may not see in just every interview with somebody with the band. So I hope you guys check that one out next week. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.